December of 1956, a boat reached the shores of Cuba. It included something like 80 people who wanted to be revolutionaries, who wanted to bring down the regime of General Batista. Yet things did not go as they liked. Because of poor planning, in a boat that should accommodate something like 20 people, there were 80 people on board, which means soon they ran out of food. The boat was very slow. They were almost drowned before they even reached Cuba. And these people did not have really the experience of battle, didn't really know how to be revolutionaries in a way, which means that they were an easy prey for Batista's armed forces, who expected them and severely bombarded them. So within a few hours, from the 80 wannabe revolutionaries, all that was left was 20 people, starving, seasick, and taking the mountains of Sierra Maestra. So there were 20 people, poorly equipped, against a whole army. Now, if you told these 20 people that not only the revolution would succeed, but that revolution would still be the regime that was the result of this revolution, would still be alive in 2021, they'd surely be surprised. But there's something even more surprising. Not only the regime in Cuba is alive, not only it survived the fall, it survived the Cold War, it survived a military intervention, it survived the fall of Soviet Union, but it is in a way the most, quote, successful socialist regime ever. In which way successful? In terms of PR, in terms of its reputation, in terms of the view that the world and the most of the intellectuals have about this regime. And the daily objective today, our objective literally, is to try and to understand how did this happen. And I started the show with this story from the first difficult hours of the revolution, because in a way, these hours set the tone for what was to follow. Because in all the years that followed, the story was the same. The few against the many, the small islands against the empire. So again, a revolution that in a way, at some point, almost brought Cuba to the pre-industrial times, I would say. So a revolution that failed in almost every possible way, somehow, even today, is celebrated, which shows the power of ideas, and it shows what is it that motivates people and what is it that, what it tells a lot about the culture. So we're going to go through the history of Cuba, and we're going to see how this regime survived. So out of these 20 people that survived, there were a guy called Fidel Castro, a young lawyer, his younger brother, Raul Castro, a young doctor from Argentina, Ernesto Guevara, also known as Che, and an idealistic student called Camilo Cienfuegos. So because of the corruption of the regime and because of the talent and the charisma in communication and in getting the sympathy of poor farmers, but also slowly gaining more and more sympathy of people who were fed up with the regime, these bands of 20 people soon managed to put together a movement, a guerrilla army of significant force that managed to bring down Batista in 59. So even before 59, in the New Year's Day of 59 or around that top point, Fidel Castro enters Havana victorious. And having brought down the dictatorship of Batista, a regime that was in every possible way or in almost every possible way, a horrendous regime, a regime resorting to terror, torture, execution, secret police and all that stuff. So the view in the world is, who is these idealistic people with the beards that have liberated Cuba? And Fidel Castro goes to the United States. He stays in Harlem because he wants to, that guy knew communication. He wants to pass the message that my struggle is also your struggle, poor Black Brothers in America. And from the United Nations, he condemns imperialism and he says that we are here to stay and now Cuba is for Cubans. So initially the revolution was not a socialist revolution. It was a, I would say, typical Latin American populist revolution. So Fidel was more, he had this socialist, let's say, quasi-socialist narrative, but mostly it was the typical, almost Perón style in some ways, populism of Latin America. He nationalizes some, he nationalizes private property, property also belonging to Americans, and he, his relationship with the United States starts getting more and more a relationship of tension, if not hostility. And then within 2 years, we have a moment that really, really played a big role in the future of Cuba. And again, it tells us a lot about what it means to have a moral versus a pragmatist foreign policy. So a lot of dissidents, a lot of people who were against Castro had fled to the United States. These people had formed something like a militia, something like a small army. And with the training of the CIA, they decide to attack Cuba. And it was the, how it's called in, I have the Greek name in my mind, the, not the pig, the Bay of Pigs, the Bay of Pigs invasion in 69. The Bay of Pigs invasion is a huge fiasco because by that time, the administration in the United States had changed. The CIA is on board with the operation, but the central political authority in the United States, Kennedy, is not fully on board. So what happens is when these people reach Cuba, basically they're on their own. And Castro, within days, destroys them. And now, the dream that Castro had about himself, we are the few versus the many, now suddenly it's a reality. Now suddenly, I stand against the empire. Now suddenly, it is the imperialists are attacking us. And he takes it on the Cuban people. After the invasion in the Bay of Pigs, we have even more political oppression. We have even more, we have show trials, even more show trials. Many people end to prison, and it was not fun to be in a prison in Cuba under Fidel Castro. And even more important in terms of geopolitics, Fidel Castro falls in the hands of, actually, voluntarily falls in the hands of Soviet Union. So notice again here, this half-hearted approach by the United States. They don't have the moral certainty to say, look, you're a dictator, we're taking you down. But they put in front these dissidents and they help them. But then at the last moment, they say, okay, we don't want much to do with that. This is what Ayn Rand talks about pragmatism and how pragmatism is a recipe for disaster. So Fidel comes to the, basically falls to the sphere of influence of Soviet Union. Khrushchev puts nuclear weapons in Cuba, supposedly to support Cuba. In 62, we almost reach a nuclear war, although people who, there are many historians who claim we never really got that close to a nuclear war in 62, but it was a situation where, at least in official history, in most people's minds, it was the closest that the war ever came to nuclear war. With the blockade of the United States around Cuba, the Soviet ships going towards Cuba, last minute there was a de-escalation, and basically the deal was Soviet Union says we take the missiles away, United States says we're not gonna invade Cuba. Again, though, Fidel Castro is having a blast because, again, his narrative is it's me versus the empire. And this is the narrative he also sells to the Cuban people. So he says, are you with me or are you with the people who are going to annihilate us with nuclear war and who attacked us last year? So we see again this narrative. Now, Cuba, within 10 years is fully within the engulfment of Soviet Union. However, interestingly, it doesn't even have the usual early, not success, how to put it, the usual results that a newly industrialized social country has to show. Oh, we have factories, output of steel or whatever. Che Guevara actually in the first years of the revolution takes over the finance ministry. Maybe he's even a worse finance minister than Varoufakis. I don't know. Maybe. One could make this argument. So within some years, Cuba, even for food, you have to, food is, you have to get it by ratio or something. But Che says, my mission here is done. He tries to bring the revolution abroad. He goes to Congo initially, I think, then to Bolivia. Both of his endeavors fail miserably, and he ends up killed by the Bolivian army in the mountains. But his legend lives on. And again, this is a legend that plays a big role in the image of Cuba, because the image of Cuba is nothing for us, everything for everyone else. It's the dream of a quote altruist, right? It's the dream of sacrifice. Che Guevara would be the number one celebrity in Cuba. He says, no, I'm going to leave. And still, Fidel Castro soon realizes that's what we Cubans are. We're about sacrifice. So in 72, I think Cuba joins the COMECON, which is the Economic Union of the Warsaw Pact, to put it this way. But the Cuban economy is doing really, really, really bad. Of course, there's a convenient excuse, the embargo. It's because of the embargo that we cannot do well. So, by the way, it's interesting with the leftists. They don't like free trade, but it's the embargo why Cuba is in its knees. By the way, in these years, most of the trade was with the Eastern Bloc, so the embargo cannot really explain why Cuba's economy did never really kick off. So what happens then? So, however, because Fidel is more clever than the Artirios, that's a political phrase, but it won't make sense to Greek. He's more clever than the stack minds in the Eastern Bloc. So Cuba never really looks like a Warsaw Pact country. You're not going to find statues of Lenin and all that stuff. And the image of the leadership, the language they use is different. It includes a lot of Cuban culture and more of a nationalist voice that the Cubans, it's more easily digestible. And then in the mid-70s, Cuba, amidst all these problems, they discover their new big mission, which is we're going to spread the revolution abroad. We're starving. Our country is basically stuck in where it was in 59, the economy. Actually, no, it's even worse. But because that's who we are, the heroic revolutionaries, we're going to help our brothers in Africa. So Fidel gets involved in the civil war in Angola. He gets involved in other anti-colonial conflicts in Africa. So Cuba is starving, but he's spending a lot of money and he's sending a lot of troops in proletarian solidarity to Angola. And he loves this image. This is how he sees himself. Notice something when you see photos of Fidel. The average Soviet politician, or today North Korea, you see they have all these awards. It's like if you have a magnet, the magnet's going to absorb them because of all these absorbs. Fidel had only one thing here, the flag of Angola. Why? Because that was his message. He says, my biggest, let's say, the thing I'm proudest of is that I've helped my brothers over there. So the story is kept alive. And the story is kept alive also with the clapping of leftist intellectuals all over the world, because now they have a good story, a new story. Well, yeah, Soviet Union, there was the brutal years of Stalinism, the brutal crushing of the Hungarian Revolution. In 68, the brutal crushing of the Prague Spring. But there's also Cuba. There's also this other place where socialism is different. People are dancing in the streets. People are happy. There are no gulags. Of course, there were prisons and concentration camps, but there, you didn't have these images with the tanks in the streets as you had in the countries of the Warsaw. So the useful idiots, the leftist intellectuals, or generally most of the intellectuals, are Cuba. It's different there. It's, this time it's going to be different. And see, they're helping in Africa. So again, see how these well-absorbed ideas in the population about self-sacrifice. It's not about us. We're helping others. And we are poor, but we are poor and there's dignity in this poverty. See how this played such a big role. Okay, let's take 1 second break to see if there's any super chats or any questions. Okay, I asked Razi to send me all these things at the end. So actually, let's go on with our history, and I'm gonna get to super chats at the end. So here we see, here now we reach the most crucial, perhaps, moment, turning point in the modern history of Cuba, which is the fall of Soviet Union and the fall of the Eastern Bloc. Now, as I said, the Eastern Bloc was actually, and a lot of people misunderstand this. They say, oh, the Soviet Empire was actually leaking stuff, was actually exploiting these other countries. Yes, it was exploiting these other countries, quote, politically, but economically, Soviet Union was actually helping these economies, quote, economies, maintain this even very low level, particularly in the case of Cuba. So with the fall of Soviet Union, and now with Yeltsin in power, and Soviet and Russia, not the Communist Party, not being in power, Cuba finds itself alone. And again, we are on the same story. We are alone versus the world. This time here, socialism will not collapse. And they make poverty a virtue. So Fidel called this, this is going to be the special period. And this special period for us who have read Atlas Shrugged reminds us one name, Starnsville. That village you remember in Atlas that almost within 10 years went from a prosperous industrial village to a pre-industrial, I don't even know how to call it. Well, something like that happened to Cuba, except that it didn't go from a successful industrial to a pre-industrial. It went to a stuck economy, to an economy which you would literally move with plows and with animals. Very big, lacking in electricity, in fuels, in foods, in food supplies. So Cuba is on its knees. And yet, again, with the help of the useful idiots in the West, that charismatic, in a bad way, because you can be evil and charismatic, but definitely charismatic in terms of understanding politics, mind that was Fidel Castro, says, oh, that story can feed us as well. Now, we are the poor who still stand on our knees. We're not gonna bow to the empire. So you have a population which is, again, living in pre-industrial conditions. And in 94, you have, for the first time, people getting very, very angry and expressing this anger in the streets. But even that, the regime manages to make it, to turn it into an opportunity. So very quickly, the crowds are dispersed. And then Fidel Castro himself goes there and he supposedly addresses the angry people, and then the angry people say, okay, Fidel, you're right, and they go home. So they say, look, they trust us here. This is not Tiananmen. There is trust here between us and the population. Now, why does Cuba at that time, why does the world not say, okay, look, this bad joke has lasted too much. Let the people live. Let the people free to live and make their life better. But no, because this is the time where supposedly, quote, neoliberalism triumphs in the world. And for the intellectuals in the West, Cuba, together with, at that time, very early stages, Brazil and Venezuela, were a new political persona called Hugo Chavez appears. Now they are making with Cuba this axis of resistance to neoliberalism. So every leftist academic, they're like, oh, I'm going to close my eyes to the suffering in Cuba because it's part of this anti-neoliberal axis. And even the Pope, John Paul, the anti-communist Pope, goes to Cuba and in a way sanctions Castro because Castro understands that now the enemy is the New World Order. And I can even get some conservatives with me. So he, you know, he opens churches, even an Orthodox church. By the way, there's a story with the Orthodox Church in Cuba, which includes yours truly and how he came close to meet Fidel Castro in my communist years. But I'll probably leave this story for Clubhouse. So this is what happens in actually this special period. How does Cuba come out of that? The country of dignity. How does the country of dignity come out of that? Well, by two heavy industries, quote, tourism and prostitution. And that's why, again, you know, the leftists are, oh, it's dignity. And they don't want to see the dignity of selling your body for dollars. But the tourist industry, which it includes in a way with it the prostitution industry, gives access to dollars. And this is what keeps Cuba alive. And then, because I mentioned the useful idiots, let's not forget the useful idiots of the United Nations, where they find something very virtuous in what Cuba is doing, which is basically returning to pre-industrial modes of agriculture because it's organic agriculture. Of course, it's organic. When you don't have machines, when you don't have the fertilizers or whatever, and you, yes, it's organic. So Cuba becomes this model of sustainable development, quote development. It becomes this model of sustainable agriculture, and the United Nations is clapping. Anyway, so that's what happens with the primitivism and the pre-industrial economy of Cuba masquerading as sustainable development and as environmentalism. And of course, Fidel, again, very, very, very clever guy. Forget this, what we're telling you in the 70s about socialist development. No, now it's the ecology, and now it's about the anti-globalization movement, and now it's about, we're gonna help you, we're gonna save you from these bad companies, multinationals and the GMOs and all that stuff. So this is in a way the story of Cuba 2006. And of course, during all these years, you have still Hollywood celebrities, particularly Latin American, very prominent authors going to Cuba, interviewing Castro. And because that's the level of understanding, usually their most question they can push him on is, why don't you do elections? So who cares about freedom of speech? Who cares about property rights? Why don't you do elections? And of course, Fidel, again, he's too clever for that. He says, well, and you people are doing elections and you elect George Bush, remember these years. And of course, the left goes, yeah, well, I guess you're right. Yeah, well, who is to say we are better? You know, we elect Bush, you don't have democracy. These are small differences. Anyway. So this is the situation with Cuba. But again, because it based its image in this idea of sacrifice, in this idea of moral ideals, and in a way it was a revolution that almost stayed young in a way because its biggest heroes, Camilo Cienfuegos, who actually from what we know, he wasn't the type of power laster like the rest of them. He died early, very early in an airplane crash. Che Guevara died very early, very young in Bolivia. Fidel always kept for himself this image of this young guy. So this revolution didn't have the image, let's say, that the Soviet Union have of the boring bureaucrat. Now, I remember in Greece, I remember my uncle who was, he's still a socialist. So the equivalent of here in the UK, someone voting Labour. I remember in his first mobile phone, he had in the, as print screen, that famous poster with, that famous photo with Fidel and Che Guevara together. Or even center-left people who say, we have all the respect for Cuba. Again, why? Because they are virtuous in their poverty. They kept their dignity. They didn't sell out. Another way to say, they sacrificed. Another way to say, they didn't live their lives and they let their lives go by, but somehow this is good. Not to say, of course, how famous Cuba is among leftists. I remember in the Greek university, the Communist Student Union, we had the chant, which doesn't translate well in English. It was something like, the star of Fidel Castro is shining and our university is going to become a red castle. It rhymes well in Greece. And when we were singing, it was like an earthquake. We were pumping our feet. It was, everyone was, again, Cuba was this other place, other over there, where we would project our fantasies. Yes, of course, we wouldn't want to live there even for 2 weeks, unless it was a nice resort hotel, but it's this place, other, this time socialism worked there. It has shown that socialism can have a human face. Of course, the human face was, again, the political prisoners, supposedly the best healthcare system in the world, but okay. So where am I getting with all that? The power of ideas, the power of this idea that morality equals you are the underdog. Elan Zurno, in the book, What Justice Demands, calls it the underdog principle. The moment you are the underdog, you're good. It doesn't matter if you are a horrendous regime. It doesn't matter if you are one of the most failed regimes in all possible ways. No, no, you're the underdog, therefore you're good. And again, well done to the useful idiots, first of them, myself, till some years, who gave this sanction and this legitimacy to Cuba and would go to Cuba and they would say to the Cuban people, oh, we admire what you're doing so much. We admire your sacrifices so much. And all the intellectuals and the political leaders, and of course the Cuban regime would parade them. They say, look, we are the envy of the world. And in a way, they weren't entirely lying. They were the envy of the intellectuals. Anyway, I could be talking about my experience and my stories from Cuba forever, but okay. Many thanks to Marilyn, many thanks to Sammy for your super chats. Let's see if we have anything else. And if not, I will say something about something that the Ayn Rand Center UK is doing and something I've benefited a lot. So I've mentioned many times the communication bootcamp, and which is this training session, so to speak, that we have with Don Watkins that is only open to ARC UK members. Now, every week, someone is submitting something, a speech, an article, and Don is going through it and suggesting developments, improvements, and explaining what went right and what went wrong. So last Thursday, the topic of the bootcamp was a mini version of this episode. So I already knew that I wanted to do something on Cuba. So I put my plan, so to speak, in a very short version of what ended up to being something like a 30-minute episode to Don. And his comments and the comments of the other people who were there were of so much value for me. They were of immense value. So I get so much out of the communication bootcamp, and you will also get much out of it. Because again, Don Watkins is, he's top level when it comes to communication. It's almost, to me, it's unbelievable in a way that we have him accessible so easily to give us, to help us and to give us feedback. So become a member of the Ayn Rand Center UK, ayn rand center.co.uk/membership. I think Raz is gonna, you're gonna find it. It's on the link of every video on YouTube. So that's all from me. Join me on Clubhouse if you want to discuss something related to this episode. Why you think Cuba has this very good PR? Why do you think Cuba managed to survive when so many other regimes, richer regimes and regimes with stronger army and all that stuff, collapsed, and whether maybe it is indeed what was my solution to the riddle, which is it's the power of ideas and how the regime managed to present itself as this almost the David versus the Goliath. Anyway, thank you very much for joining me in this solo episode, and I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.